A quick note before we start. About 70% of all people who listen to the show on Apple or Spotify don't follow the podcast. If you like the show, please hit that follow button. It ensures that you don't miss an episode, and it really helps spread awareness of the conversations we're having. And if you can leave a comment or a rating, that's even better. Thank you. Okay, let's get back to the show.
I'm Andrew Kitley, and this is my podcast, The Invisible Gift, a show about turning disability into possibility. From a young age, I was told I had a disability that would make it impossible for me to achieve and flourish in life. I struggled in school and felt I was not truly understood or supported. On my long road to becoming the owner of multiple businesses, I have learned that dyslexia was not my disability, but rather my invisible gift. My dyslexia challenged me every day, but it was also what made me into an independent thinker, a creative, and gave me that hard-working mindset that has taught me to never be discouraged by failure. I realised there are many people out there just like me. So I wanted to learn more about them and how we can all transform our greatest challenge into our invisible gift. Welcome to my podcast. Can you believe we're in the last episode of the season?
To be honest, mate, I can't.
We've grown so close.
I know. I really enjoy this. I've been behind the microphone for so long as a producer of podcasts. It's refreshing to get this side of the microphone and contribute.
It just feels like we've only just started and now we're finishing.
I know. What a season it's been too.
I know. Well, guys, if you haven't listened to the rest of the season, if you're just tuning in now, where have you been?
We started with the BBC actress Cara Toynton and winner of Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah.
We moved on to talk to the likes of Tanya Bardsley.
Yeah.
We spoke to Willard, the guy who makes the microscopic art on the heads of pins. We spoke to Carrie Britton, the BBC producer. Michelle Catterson from the school in Reigate.
Yeah, Rossi, the comic. And let's not forget the professor.
Oh, yeah, the professor, Nigel Lockett.
Yeah.
Now, many people might think that you aren't taking this seriously or that you don't respect or not grateful for having all these guests. But I've come to realise that that isn't a case of you not caring. Because when we first started working together, I was like, who is this joker? I can't even remember the names of these guests. Now I realise it's just part of dyslexia.
Yeah, and do you know what I'm not worried about? I'm not worried about the listeners because they can definitely sympathise with what I'm going through. I guarantee they're sitting there now going, yep, I would have done that.
So last week, I'm sure you'll remember that you spoke to the BBC producer, Carrie Britton.
How could you forget that?
Well, you couldn't. I think it's fair to say Carrie was an impressive guest. She campaigns around neurodiversity at the BBC. She has accolades to her name, including being involved with the creation of Embarrassing Bodies and Who Do You Think You Are?
I mean, they're programmes you kind of grew up on, aren't they? Who do you think you are? I mean, if you wanted a tearjerker when you're younger, that was the programme.
And Embarrassing Bodies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that tearjerked for another reason.
in a different kind of way. The conversation that you had with her was inspiring on many levels.
Yeah, do you know, Carrie was really a different guest for me because she's a massive fan of the show and that blew me away. That meant because the show is obviously quite new. We're only in season two, right? But she kind of knew everything about all the different episodes and it was really great speaking to her. And it was really kind of, she blew me away. And what she's achieved in her life so far is unbelievable. I can't imagine what she's going to achieve in the next 20 years.
Oh, it was great to have someone who's such a fan of The Invisible Gift and the work that we're doing. I think we both went away and reflected on that. And it is an absolute motivation to continue making this into future seasons. This week,
yes,
you sat down with, and I know you're excited about this one, the award-winning illustrator and children's author, Sally Gardner.
Yeah, I mean, I was excited before the podcast, but afterwards, wow, what a person.
She is one hell of a storyteller.
I was glued.
She talks in stories.
Yes, she talks. Every word is a story. And ultimately, my biggest teacher on this podcast.
Do you think?
Without a shadow of a doubt. When she walked out, I was like, I just thought, what power you could have in a normal life. Forget everything else amazing that she's doing and incredible things everyone does that we, all the guests we meet on the show. If I could turn every single conversation in a story like that. You just, she held the attention. I was bated breath the whole time.
And I think, you know, to share a little bit of behind the scenes, I, as a producer of podcasts, we make a whole stable of shows, you can become a bit numb to it, you know, like you sit through a lot of recordings, or I have sat through lots of recordings with all kinds of different people. And it's fair to say that after a while, you sort of switch off a bit because, you know, it's kind of work. You're not necessarily personally interested in everything and you've got things to do in your day-to-day life. But for this one, you ran the longest of any conversation that we've had.
You let us go longer.
And I listened to every last word. I mean, partly because she is such an incredible storyteller. Everything she says is in a story. She does the brilliant, talented thing of tying back to previous stories. She creates an arc through everything. It's brilliantly done, but it's just fascinating because it's also a story of necessity. It's a story of survival. It's a story of success. It's a story of being underestimated. It's a story of progress. It's, I mean, I don't know what more we can say about it. We should probably just roll the tape, shouldn't we?
Let's just listen to it, James. So thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So let's go back to the beginning then. So yep. how you started, because it is unique to be dyslexic and then get to where you've got with the amount of books you've got. So when did you find out you were dyslexic?
Well, I went to school at six, like lots of people did. And I knew something was very wrong pretty early on. I got it that I went and joined a ballet class. I could never get the steps right. Couldn't keep with everybody. Hmm. And I was a bit of a clown. I was quite pretty with lots of curly hair and people laughed at me. And then I went to school and I thought, is this right? That these words jump around like circus horses on the blackboard. And then they would start going, and I thought, oh, they've got speech impediments, something really wrong with these teachers. And then they took away the picture of the cat and that was the end of it. I couldn't make head or tail of it. I couldn't understand why such a little word could be a cat.
Yeah.
It didn't have a tail. It didn't have anything feline about it. It was dull.
Yeah.
And then the words just moved. They just would, I don't know about you, but they would go in a ribbon for me. They danced like that. And I used to remember looking at the ceiling and people said, why are you looking at the ceiling? Because I'd go, well, perhaps the words are up there because they sure ain't staying on the board.
Yeah, I used to have individual letters blur and unblur as I was reading them.
And then you get people who, it goes all black. I've known people who've, and then the other thing that, and you just get migraines, terrible headaches. Mm. So I knew it was something really wrong. And then I got left behind at school and I got on a reading scheme called Janet and John and they got changed to Peter and Jane. And I spent entirety of my small life writing in my head murder stories about how to kill Peter and Jane and Janet and John. So I got through about three volumes of the murder of these two.
So what is Peter, Jane, Janet?
They were a reading scheme. They're a reading scheme. And I never got beyond, get this, Peter and Jane have a ball.
Hmm.
I was 11.
Yeah.
And I was still on Peter and Jane have a ball. They did get a dog called Pat. And I liked the dog. And they fed it sweets. And I thought, damn it, needs a good place. So I started bumping them off in my head.
And that was your first book?
I told my brother, I made him laugh a lot about, yeah, how are we going to kill Peter and Jane today? I've got a plan.
So when you used to come up with it, that's really interesting. So when you used to come up with them ideas about the stories, did you ever write them down or just think them? Was that just purely in the mind?
So I got to do a diary. You know, everyone says you've got to keep, you know, try and write. So all I could do is, it is a sunny day. My head had every other word in the world, but I could only write, it was a sunny day. The cat sat on mat. I mean, it was that limited.
Yeah.
And I finally at 11, it was so chronic. Mm. I was called Sarah and I couldn't work out where that H went. It had little boots on and it would walk all the way through my name.
Mm.
And a friend of my mother's was an actress. And she said, oh, darling, it's very simple. You've got a big S like a snake. and then a little A with a twiggle, and then two L's and a big Y to catch it all in.
Yeah.
I thought, oh, I can do that. So I changed my name to Sally because it was only way I could get past the problem I was having. So I became Silly Sally. That was my tag name all through my age of commission.
So I love the way you were explaining the way you treat words. So you said, like, you couldn't work out that where that H went, and it just went walking all through your mind. It's quite obviously you write stories, but is that how you visualize everything? Even now, whenever you have conversations, do you kind of departmentalize them and create little stories in your head as when you?
Yes.
That must be amazing. I know a lot of people must say that's weird, but for me, that sounds like a really.
I can make up a story about anything. I just have that kind of brain. And I turn stories and I twist them and I play with them and I sort of juggle them and see where they're going to land and how they're going to work. And also, I have an ability, which I thought everybody had. So this is what I thought everybody could do. Okay. So I went to art school and I studied theatre design.
Yeah.
And so education disaster. And then I went to an art school and I started to go a bit like a champagne cork being released. I started going up the scale a bit.
Yeah.
And I remember being with a director who has to remain nameless because this is quite not a good story on him.
Yeah.
And I was showing him all these books because I was doing The Tempest for my degree show, and I was showing him all the books. He said, you know, I can't see this. I just looked at him. What? But you must be able to. He went, no, I can't. And I said, you're blind. And he nearly hit me. But the thing about this was, to me, it was the biggest revelation of my teenage years.
Mm.
More than anything else, actually, because I thought everyone had a cinema in their head. So when someone would say what we were doing today or what it was like out there, you could just see it.
Yeah.
You'd have the ability to make things move around and you'd see it 3D. And to realize that people couldn't was flabbergasting to me. I couldn't. And yet, not knowing 2 and 2 made 4, everyone thought it was a real problem.
Yeah.
Like, why should they make 4? I don't understand that. But why can't you see in 3D?
Yeah, why can't you visualize? So I have that now. So whenever, being a structural engineer, whenever I look at something, I always say to people, I can visualize it. And I think people think when I say that, it's just like, oh, I can imagine it there. But I can actually see it.
Of course you
can. I can see it. I can spin it. I can pull it apart. I can put it back together. And that's what I found technology's really changed for me. You see on computers where people design something, say like we design that box there, and then they design it on a computer and they pull it all apart and then they show you how it all works together.
You can
That's how I've been visualizing things all my life.
Yeah.
And it's not even just physical things, it's personalities and everything. You're right, that's how I felt. I thought, surely this is something that can happen for everyone.
Yeah. But it can't, and it doesn't. And I remember I was a set designer for a long time. I did a show in Newcastle years ago with 1,500 car tyres. Had never been done before. No one used car tyres. And I remember going to go and get the car tyres. It was in Newcastle, you have to bear in mind. And this man, the driver, had taken me. And the man wouldn't talk to me. I said what car tyres I wanted. He said to the driver, so can you tell me why, in a Newcastle accent, will you tell me why you're here? And the guy looked at me and went, no, I didn't hear anything, the man said. So I had to translate through this guy, saying, could you ask him, we don't want Mini. And in the end, he took me out into his yard and he said, this is what we do with tyres for ladies. We make flower pots for them. And anyway, I remember I had got 1,500 car tyres. That's a hell of a lot of car tyres.
Wow.
1,500. They were all free. They're these remolds. Don't ever get one. But anyway, they all turned up. And I remember my head of design, who was wonderful chap called Martin, and he said, well, darling, if any one of them is left over, I'm going to wring it round your neck, because what are we going to do with it? And I remember absolutely feeling, oh, I'm going to pass out, when all this huge pentagonal lorry turned up. But actually, every single one of them was used. We made, it was about the gods turning up. It was a Boltov Brecht play. And we had the gods sitting on top of the towers, and they walked in and they wobbled. So then the fire officer turned up and he said, oh, I'd like to see the man who'd signed this, please. So I come along. He go, no, we want to see the man who designed this. I go, I don't know what to do because I designed it. He went, no, we want to see. So my head of design had to come down and be there. Anyway, the long and short of it is every night the fire officers stood with a hose because tires are combustible. Mm. But as I didn't like to point out, when they went home, tires didn't know they'd gone home. They could still ignite. But they hadn't thought about that one. But the thing was, my director said to me, he knew I was dyslexic. And he said, so, you know, what I think we need at the very end of this is a cloth that says good woman of sex one. I went, okay, I'll do that. He said, yeah, okay. But I don't want you looking at the word. I went, what? I mean, without the word, I'm... No, you know, just do it, Sal, just do it. So on the opening night, the cloth went up and the actors hold it up. And there is, I mean, there's a standing ovation. There is laughter to the hill. I have written The Good Woman of Saturna. It's totally backwards. It's absolutely jumbled. Hmm. And it gets a round of applause. My head of design nearly had a fit and writes it all out neatly the next day. The director goes bonkers. No, we will only have the badly spelt cloth.
What?
Yeah. So that went up every night. My dyslexic, the good woman cloth.
That's brilliant. So you went from set designing.
Yeah.
And then what pushed you into writing after that then?
Well, I had children. Mm-hmm. I became an illustrator. I had a bailiff. Mm-hmm. I was married with three children, and my ex-husband went to America. Mm-hmm. And he decided the world was full of other things. Mm-hmm. And I've never met a man with a barcode on him. And I don't want to be with someone who doesn't want to be with me. You know, that's just the end of it. Let it be. It was a mess. And my agent said to me, darling, you're not going to make the money. You're only illustrating for children. You'll not make it. She said, you are writing. I know you are. But you've never shown anyone. I can't spell. Yeah. And she said, well, I've got someone who can help with that. So I'd been writing in exercise books, you know, children's exercise books. I'd left a gap and I'd been rewriting it. It's called The Strongest Girl in the World. And I got all the exercise books together. And I cut a hole in a Sainsbury's bag and I took them on the bus and I had to go to Soho and I decided if they all fell out, then that I wasn't meant to be a writer.
Wow.
And I thought, when I got to Soho, they were nearly coming out of the bag and I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to give up on this. I'm going to have to do something else. I don't know what, but it's not going to happen. And this woman started running down the street with a scarf. And I thought, what's she doing running down the street? And she scooped it up. She said, I know what you're up to. You think they're going to fall out. You're not going to write that book. And this what? Was the woman who my agent had got me to help get it into non-dyslexia land for me, into English. And that was the start. And that book, funnily enough, was printed with only one sentence altered. One sentence, never happened again in my life, by the way, but that happened that time. And then I had a wonderful, wonderful editor at the time called Judith Elliott. And she said, you know, you're a writer. I said, but, Judith, I'm really, really dyslexic. She said, I don't think that stops you being a writer. And I said, you don't think it matters? I can't spell the words? Mm-mm-mm-mm. So anyway... Jane Fuhr helped me again to get it out of dyslexia. But it was quite interesting because I sent her the beginning bit of I, Coriander, and she said this thing to me, which I never forgot. She phoned me up and she said, I knew you could write, but I didn't know you could write. It really was, for me, it was the best thing to have said.
So I can't not ask this question. When you said you cut a hole in the Sainsbury's bag.
Yeah.
How did you decide how big the hole was?
Oh, I made it quite big. So when the books were in there, it was so that corner edge was out. And there were quite a lot of them.
Right. So you've done it because obviously, depending on the size of the hole, is
no, you've got to
for
give
me
the books,
would determine how much you really wanted
no,
to do.
No,
it,
you've got to give the books a chance to really fall. So I did cut quite a whack. So they were down already. They were, you know, they were at an angle.
What made you come up with that idea? It's something I've never heard, but it's kind of, yeah, it's really deep.
Because I didn't feel I could possibly be a writer because of my dyslexia. I felt too ashamed of what was in those, the bad spelling and everything to do with it. To be honest, that was the truth. And the only thing that made me, only thing that kicked me up the bum was necessity. I had to. Our bailiff had come and sat on my fence and he said, I can blow your house down. And I knew he could. And I just had to do something. And that's what I did. Took the books and wrote this book and it got published. And that was the start for me.
Well, I always find that out of adversity becomes some of the best things in life.
So I've got a lot to thank that old wolf for. Though I still have a relationship with him and I'm pretty terrified of him. But
again, see, you're characterising him as a wolf. Now, I'm visualising him standing outside your house as a wolf. So what do you think made you feel that your dyslexia was going to be the problem why you couldn't do anything? Because it's got to originate from somewhere, right?
Well, there's two ways this goes, and I think a lot of dyslexic people have it. Inside my little head, I had a whole world of characters who used to say to me, you can do this. Mm. You can do this. When people said, she's unteachable, which was one of the things was described to me, I would think, no, I'm not. And my little characters would go, no, you're not. You're not. You can do it. Mm. And when I was told that I would never achieve anything and my parents would have to look after me for the rest of my life, I remember thinking, no, that's not right. That's not right. Mm. And I got five O-levels. I got out of that dump of a school. I'd been to a school for maladjusted children. Mm. So that's how bad my dyslexia had got.
Yeah.
And then I got a first-class honours degree. And I remember my mother, that was quite good, at Central St Martin's, I got a first-class honours degree. And my mother said, darling, you sure you read that round the right way? And I said, there's only one way you can read one.
Yeah. Wow. So how much time do you spend a day writing?
I spend, so I always start about 9, stop for lunch. And if I can, and I'm not getting too exhausted, I will have a break, but I'll work nearly all day.
That must be, because the one thing when we've had people on the show, they say it's so hard to concentrate on things for a long period of time. But I suppose this is more because it's your love, it's a passion of yours that you find it easier.
I mean, I think there's levels of concentration. I put it like that. To be honest with you, I think in the morning I'm really quite good. Hmm. I sort of come up with something that I've obviously slept on and it's come out quite good. And then I can get very, I have realised that late at night, I can muddle a lot up. Yeah. I can suddenly go, ooh, it was all fine. And then I've just managed to go, ooh, and I read it in the morning going, what was that?
Yeah.
But now a word, for instance, things have altered considerably. So let's talk about the altering. I now have, Word does dictate on it.
Yes.
So you can write all your what I call shorthand now for my dyslexia, shorthand, and then I can just dictate it into Word, which makes life a lot simpler. And then you've got Grammarly, which is a bit American, but it's sort of all right.
Yeah.
And I like Dragon Connect, but I'm really pissed off they don't have it on Apple. I think I don't know what Apple are playing at because Apple One isn't very good. So that irritates me. So there's lots of different, you know, for someone dyslexia who wants to be a writer, there it, when I started, there was nothing.
Yeah.
Except blue, red, blue, red.
Blue, red, blue, red.
Andrew, I feel a bit bad jumping in at this point because Sally's such a compelling storyteller, and I don't want to break the flow for the listeners, but how are you finding it?
I found myself holding my breath throughout the stories in normal conversation. How does that even happen?
Just her telling the story of how she creates characters and personifies them like they're alive, you're just engrossed. It's not even a show about dyslexia at this point. It's just about how to have a conversation, how to talk.
And the fact that the way she kind of manifests them characters with us. I mean, I don't know about you guys.
Hi, everyone. I just have a quick announcement that I'm really excited to share. We're launching the Invisible Gift Community, a platform designed to provide support and resources for neurodivergent individuals. I've always been passionate about sharing conversations around being neurodivergent, raising awareness and promoting understanding, but I want to do more. So now the Invisible Gift website will offer a range of tools and resources to help neurodivergent individuals navigate the challenges any one of us can face on a daily basis. This includes information about workplace accommodations, tips for managing sensory overload, advice on how to communicate effectively, information for how to get the most out of a neurodivergent child's education, as well as providing the building blocks for them to have a successful life and much more. But to do this, we need your input. We are looking for therapists, influencers, business leaders, HR, and brand representatives to provide their input and support. If you're one of these people that wants to support neurodivergence, or if you just believe you can really help out, send my team an email on hello@theinvisiblegift.com and you can find more information on the Invisible Gift website. With your help, we can really turn neurodiversity into possibility. Okay, back to the show.
Listening, but I'm locked in. I am locked in.
I tell you what, at this point, normally I've got notes here, like she's going to talk about the education system and how it failed her and restless leg syndrome, but let's just
get back in.
So now that you've obviously from the start where you first started writing and you had the producers come in and help you to the stage where you are now, do you find it easier or is it easier for you to understand the right spelling for words now? So whereas you would struggle with one word because you've used it so many times and so many books now, is it now easier for you and you spell it correctly this time?
Well, I think it's true to say I have been working with words now for a long time, writing. When words danced on the ceiling and when they sort of went walkabout, I was at school and they didn't stick. I couldn't make sense of them. It has got better. It hasn't gone away. And if I'm tired or if I'm flustered, I can turn anything round and make it go wrong way round for me. But I deal with words every day and I have done for, 20 years? So yes, things have definitely improved and technology has caught up to help me.
Yeah.
So what I needed at the beginning was someone there to really be the spell check, to be the grammar.
Yeah.
And there was nobody.
Right.
And that's when I said I couldn't get a clean script. That's what I meant. Because I can't do that. My dyslexia is severe and I can't get it like that. I don't see the little words.
Yeah.
That is one of my big problems. I can do a whole sentence and leave out two.
Yeah.
It makes no sense. Right. Or leave out A. It makes no sense. And I can't see it. When I read it back to someone, it's on the page.
It's in there, yes.
It's in there.
It's exactly everyone's
going,
what I have.
It's not there, Sally. It's not there. And I really have to look and go, oh God, it's not there.
I write things and reread it and I have this. My wife helps me out with a lot of things, writing related, and she's like, this sentence doesn't make sense. I'm like, it does. And I reread it, and every time I reread it, she's like, you've added a word.
Yeah.
I was like, where? It's there, and it's never there. So you that brings us on to reading. You said earlier that you struggled reading like most dyslexic people do, and words used to jump around. When you're getting scripts back now from people, how are you with reading that then?
No, because it's my words. Sorry to be quite narcissistic about that. That's really, it's about me. No, but they're my words. Yeah. And so in a way, I know them because I've read them so many times again and again and again to get what I want out of them. So I enjoy that bit. I enjoy that bit.
So, if I gave you something that wasn't yours, like I assume you'd probably like reading other people's books.
I love reading.
Yeah,
I love.
So, how has your reading improved over the years?
Well, the words don't jump as much as they used to. Yeah. That's for sure. If I'm tired, they do. Mm-hmm. But that's tired.
Yeah.
And if I can get it on an RNIB or if I can get it on an audio, I would rather listen.
Mm.
Because I'm on a screen all day. And then just to be on, I find Kindle quite useful.
Yeah.
Because you can blow the words up and you can put it into dyslexy font and no one need know. I think the Kindles are very good for that.
I find when I read, the reason why I choose audiobooks over reading is because if I read something, I tend to reread sentences over and over again. And I sometimes, to get the meaning, I have to reread it to try and understand it. And if I read a page and then went back and reread it,
it would mean
something completely different. Yeah. But audio, it allows me to engulf myself in the story. Yeah. And I think that's why I connect so, because a lot of non-dyslexic people can't get their head around the idea of audio, as in they don't understand why you would want to listen to a book and not read it. And people always find it weird now, because I always say, oh, I listened to that book, and my parents who love reading, they're like, that's just weird. It sounds wrong saying I listened to a book.
But this is one of my bugbears with teachers, okay, at school. Because I think if you listen to an unabridged book, you're as good as read it.
Yeah.
Because I don't go to sleep on those books, whereas I see people go to sleep all the time on books. I never go to sleep on audio. And if I think, oh, I didn't hear that, I go back. Mm. And I think, you know, if you were, it should be as valid. And I find this class system, I read it, you listened, me more valid. A really bad way of looking at things.
But I think I agree, you have to be present in listening. A lot of people listen to things while they're exercising and stuff like that. I think there's got to be a certain amount of concentration, like you would with a book anyway.
Yeah.
But I find it the opposite. If I try, and I'm actually a good reader, and I've been a good reader for a long time because I just love books.
Yeah.
But if I read it, I find that other things disturb me. Whereas when I listen to it,
nothing disturbs
me. I'm in the story so much. And as I'm hearing it, the visualization of it's going through my mind. I'm creating the story. So it's like, I always say to people, it's like watching TV for me. So I can visualize where I am. I feel the environment I'm in. And that's what's so important.
I don't like watching television very much. Do you have the same?
I watch loads of television, but not properly. I have it in the background because background noise is, it's kind of like how a lot of people feel. Background noise is like white noise for me. It just helps because I've got ADHD as well.
Yeah.
It's the only thing that calms my brain down. Yeah.
My brother had it the same problem.
Yeah, so I have it in the background.
Yeah.
But I don't. I very rarely watch anything. On odd occasions, saying, well, really, and then I'm in it.
Yeah.
I sit there. But no, I do go through stages. Me and my wife went through 2 years of not watching TV at all. Like, just completely stopped watching it. And I think that's just to do with what was on TV. But at the time, we'd both started personal development, and we really just got into books and podcasts, and we just become obsessed with gathering information in our brains. So I think that's what's really changed. Yeah. It must take a lot of your power, a lot of brain power, to kind of memorize all the stuff you do, all your stories and everything, because you say you rewrite all your words regularly. When you're doing a story, you read them, rewrite them. The one thing I struggle with, I have a terrible memory. How do you kind of cope with that? Or is that something that you don't have an issue with?
No, I have my memory is not good. And interestingly, I lose parts of my story, and I will have said it to my editor. My editor will go, this isn't exactly what you talked to me about. And actually, I had a very good editor on Snow Song, and I've never worked with a man before. And he said to me, do you know, too much of it's in your head still, not enough on the paper. And that was no one had really ever said that to me. And it was actually really good to make me think, yes, that is true. Because I work everything out, like all the characters all the way down the line. But actually, I hadn't quite put all that on the paper. it's so there in my head, if you see what I mean. I can see it all, and I haven't quite translated it to the little flat page.
Yeah, because I think, listen, I find storytelling in any form really hard to do, because before you start with a story, you've got to kind of understand the ending. And I mean, you've got character arcs as the story goes on.
No, you don't understand the ending.
Oh, you don't?
That's the thing. You don't understand the ending. No. So there are different ways of writing. So there are people that plot all the way through, what I call sticky note writers. And they, you know, person's going to die on page 7.
Yeah.
And the conclusion is going to be on page 85. And there's going to be a twist. And on page 355, you're going to find out what it's all about.
Hmm.
I can't do that. So I wrote a book called The Double Shadow. And there was a character in there who had to die.
Yeah.
Okay. He was supposed to die in chapter 3. Hmm. Chapter, I think, 11 or 7. He's still alive. Still happily going strong. I haven't managed to kill him. And I really found that interesting.
Yeah.
I found his determination to stick with it, even though I wanted him off, fascinating.
So the way you've just said that, it's you speak like the characters themselves are living and you're almost observing. So it's because you've just said about you loved his determination. Is when you create a book, do you, you just visualizing it and then writing down almost as an observer, or are you in it? Because that's...
Well, the book I'm writing at the moment is called The Weather Woman.
Hmm.
And Neva, my main character, it's set in about 1803 to 1813, when we had the first real major climate change, weather incident happen, with a fog that came down the winter of 1812. And it came down on the 27th of December, and it lasted, I think, nearly 10 days. It lasted over Christmas into the new year. I haven't got the exact dates. And it was so thick that it was described like being underwater, with coral forming on windowsills and freezing fog. And in it was black snow, which was the soot coming from all the chimneys. So this character that I've developed is slightly autistic, slightly on the spectrum. And it's, in a way, I know about that quite a lot. And I find it really fascinating writing her and putting her down and being brave about what I know about that way of thinking.
The question I have then is having dyslexia given you the ability... It's giving you the freedom to be able to create these sort of stories in your head without the worries that I think maybe neurodiverse. See, they don't make things easy for us. Neurodiverse people would probably, if you've done better academically, do you think that may have hindered the ability that you have now?
Yeah. I think. All my life, I told stories. I stopped being bullied at school by telling ghost stories. I went to a boarding school and I scared everyone rigid. I found storytelling and making people laugh and being funny or making them frightened, I could do it. And I never, ever thought I'd get to a stage where I could be the writer to write them down. I had a head full of them. And I felt my level of dyslexia was such a mountain to climb in a way. And it isn't. It is a different way of writing. It's a different way. And by that, I mean you have to face things that other people get into straight order, straight away. They don't need to pay extra to have someone put a manuscript into, you know, so it's got full stops all in the right place and little speech bubbles were speech, you know, all those kind of. I do. I have to do that. That's sort of my money. But otherwise, I think my gift is an ability to tell story on a sixpence. I can turn it on a sixpence.
On your view, education, schools, we was quite passionately talking about this earlier. And I think it's something that we wanted to talk about. How do you think, do you have much involvement in schools now? Obviously writing children's books, and you deal with a lot of children.
I've done a lot of schools. And I've been into all sorts, absolutely from the top to the not so great. And I honestly think if school was John Lewis, it would be bankrupt by now. It doesn't work. It fails far too many children. And politicians need to get the F out of the playground and let people teach. At the moment, it's too political. And also, we accept diversity of sexuality, but we do not accept diversity in the brain. And this is what drives me bonkers. And this one-fit education just doesn't work. It's failing. And we are failing these children for this century. And we're doing it right now, right this minute. And every day, children are being excluded from school because they're dyslexic, because no one's tested them, because no one spotted them. And prison that I go into, young offenders, highest population are dyslexic. And the only other place you're going to find that level of dyslexia is in art school. What the fuck are we doing? I'm furious about it. I am absolutely, makes my blood boil.
So what's your thoughts on what? Because all the guests we have on say the same. The message is exactly the same. No one's, and we have teachers on here that feel frustrated themselves. And it's, what do you think? And I know it's not an easy question to answer, but what do you think a good solution is to the problem?
I think the good solution is a revolving door on education. So I think one of the things, if you let's take young boys, just take young boys. So they get to 13, 14, they're not getting out of bed. They're not interested in school. Okay, start school later. Get them to school at 6 in the evening. Let them go home at 11 at night. You'll have less trouble on the streets, less gangs. And they did one pilot, I read about this years ago, where they did this. And they got retired teachers to look at homework. They found out, interestingly, I like this, that most people phoned in about homework at 3 in the morning. This was the time they were most awake. I had a son, and I remember finding him at 3 in the morning reading the newspaper, being really, in a way that he never was in the morning. He was like sort of pizza dough.
Yeah.
And I think there should be a more, especially for young boys, with the problem we have at the moment with gangs and difficulty, if it was later and they could sleep through the day, get back to school at night, and have a revolving door on this. So it's not the end. If you don't take your exams at whenever, you can come back in again. We want you back in again. At the moment, it's too rigid, too fixed, and it's not helping enough. That's what I feel very strongly. And I also think we've got to start educating to the right-hand side of the brain, not the left, which is the left is academia, the right is imagination. We've got to have a more holistic, imaginative approach. My brother was 53, and he had a tummy operation. And the doctor opened him up and sewed him back down again. And he went, and he was about to get remarried. And the doctor said, "You've got 3 months to live." He said it just like that. And my bro phoned me up and he said, "Do you know the saddest thing about that conversation is that guy really needed some help. I mean, I know I'm going to die, but that guy had no gift at empathy,
no
imagination to understand what he had just said to me. He had just said it." And I thought, you know, we're not doing any favors by not helping people with little imagination and empathy by teaching only to this wrong side of the brain.
Yeah, I remember when I had left school at this time, but they changed the regulations to say that you had to stay at school till you was 18. And that was, they said it was one of the biggest impacts on the dyslexic community, because most dyslexic people are dying to leave school at 16. And they said that's been forced in staying into a place that you've been
tortured.
Yeah. I think, see, the take I would have on it, I agree with you about you've got to have the creative side and the human side, so the empathy and stuff like that, which most people with dyslexia are high emotional intelligence and low IQ. So what?
No, they're not low IQ. No, IQ is intelligent. But no, dyslexic people aren't low IQ.
But by the traditional means of assessing that.
That is because that assessment is wrong.
Yeah.
And this, and also, I'd just like to say about the IQ business. The tests are totally against us. We can't do them. So there's no way. Einstein failed at school completely. Please, would someone look at intelligence tests again? And also the other thing is, which I think is really important to talk about with children with dyslexia. So you get a child who's, let's say, mildly on the spectrum. Dog dies. Child is severely dyslexic. Yeah? But then 3 years later, child is gone back again. None of this is being looked at. None of this is being looked at. It's a blanket diagnosis. No intelligence is being used about it. And that is the heartbreak about this. So children are being classified and not looked at properly.
Yeah, I agree. But there's systems in healthcare that's the same. It's old fashioned. It's like BMI, as an example.
Yeah.
It's an old fashioned way of measuring.
I'm wrong.
Yeah. So they kind of, but sadly, we live in a world where things have to be measured a certain way. And I think what we could do in a more shorter term for education is stop putting the emphasis on English, maths and sciences, keep it there, but bring up the creative arts as something that's equally, if you're trying to get a scholarship to go into a school, if you read all the different scholarships, it's either outstanding academic performance or sports or art, music, you know, them things are great when you get in there. But yet we're not really pushing the more creative sides in schools. But we live in a world now where we're sitting in a building at the moment recording this full of creative people.
Who most probably didn't do very well at school.
Yeah. And that's what, and we now live in a time where creative people are becoming really important. And they've always been important, but they're even more important
but
now.
But also, I'd just like to say, dyslexic people are becoming more important. Because in a way, what are we? What are we really good at? Our invisible gift is the ability to visualize, to take something, to maneuver it, either to think of it in 3D, to tell a story about it, to see it in a different way. I've known lawyers who've gone in to see prisoners, and they have got out of that prisoner the whole story, and they've done it by a very simple route, by going, "Good morning, Mr. Connor." And the guy just goes, "No one has ever called me by my surname. No one. It's been fuckface, stupid, anything but who this man is." And by doing that simple thing, bingo, he got it, where no one else had done it. It's the ability to think out of the box. We are so clever. I think we're super people. But hey-ho, you go into education and sure made feel dumb.
Yeah, they don't. That's the issue. Isn't it? It's how we create a mindset earlier on in life. So what it actually does is hinder the progression of it. But I think, again, this comes back to things we've been talking about. If you hold up people like yourself to say you can achieve this, even though you've got this, then that's the way to do it. But you're right. We've all experienced nearly everyone I speak to is dyslexia. Even now, as people in their 20s still get told by some teachers, not all, because there's some amazing teachers out there doing some great things, but they still get told by some teachers that they're never going to make anything themselves.
But do you know how many teachers, how long teachers have learning about dyslexia?
Probably about the same as doctors learn about food, right?
About 3 weeks. Yeah. They learn nothing about it. They know nothing. I mean, I've spoken to people. So, for instance, if you want to get a child to read, let's say, and you give them one of those, you know, squeezy balls that you use for you make your hand strong, or anything with a scrunchiness in it. And you tell them to read without one, and then you get them to read with it, and the reading level goes up, 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 up. when boys do this at school.
Yeah.
And teachers go, stop that. I think, don't say that to the boy. It's the only way it can go in the head.
Yeah.
And none of this is looked at. I remember being read to, and I do drawings all over the place, lots and lots of them. And people go, but you're not listening. Oh, my word. Was every word not going in? Make me stop drawing. Couldn't hear it.
Yeah. But I have the same with, so I remember it really annoyed me when fidget spinners become popular.
Yeah.
Because
they weren't very good really for us.
Well, but they're good for ADHD.
They are, yeah.
So what happened was I couldn't sit through any conversation ever without starting fidgeting. And I'm still pretty bad now. That's the great thing about me having a wedding ring now, because it's like a new fidget spinner.
I think you're doing quite well. I was, yeah. When you said you got it, my brother could, well, anyway.
And the thing is, I find it kind of almost switches off when I'm really interested in something. So, the fidget spinners were great. And then everyone got them, so I stopped using mine because I didn't want to look like I jumped into a fad. But now I sit there. So when I'm doing calculations or anything like that, I sit there with my fidget spinner and it calms me down. Yeah. And I can, but as soon as that's out of my hand, so when I go into meetings, that's why I said earlier, I can't sit in meetings very long. But that's why the wedding ring's actually been amazing for me. So I just sit here and fidget.
I also have restless legs, which are very bad. And I find that, and that's apparently to do with dyslexia as well.
It is. Do you know there's a solution for that?
What is it?
I have it at home and it drives Christina mental. So she looked into finding out how to solve that. And you can buy weighted throws.
Oh, no. I had to throw mine away. Oh, my God.
Why?
Oh, my God. Oh, my word. Was I not in utter agony? So I had this weighted throw. And I'm thinking, now this is going to work. This is going to work. And my legs went just ballistic. Oh, no. I have it really bad. I'm afraid I'm really, really terrible.
It's the only thing. It's the only time I can sit still.
Oh, really?
And it's...
But it, you see, you got eight. I haven't got that. I haven't got HD.
ADHD.
Yeah, that's the one. My brother was. I'm afraid I had to give it to the dump. Nobody wanted it.
Oh, no. It's funny.
I'd have brought it in.
It's brought no end to entertainment for our guests. Whenever someone comes in the house, we say, try and pick that up.
Yeah,
and
it's really heavy.
They can't move it. Yeah. It's so heavy.
Yeah.
But
it stops you.
It stops my legs used to fly all over the place. And like I said, I only found that out in the first season from one of our guests that is a product of dyslexia.
I can't. I am afraid I'm on a drug to stop the old jitters.
Wow.
I know.
They actually have a drug to stop your legs.
Yeah, I'm afraid they do. You don't want to know about it, really, but I do. I'm on it. I got it so bad that I couldn't watch television. I couldn't sit to have a meal. It used to make me feel I was going to be ill.
So sitting there writing must have been a nightmare.
Funny. It would be all right in the day and then come by 8 o'clock at night.
It's always night.
I've got...
Mine starts at almost half seven on the dot.
And then it goes. And I can feel that horrible feeling goes down your legs. And you think, oh, yeah, it comes.
So it actually happens to me a lot. So half seven. So when I go out for a meal...
It's just a nightmare.
I'm normal 1 second and then I just turn really weird.
And then you have to stand up and people...
Well, that's why people don't like going out for meals with me, because as soon as we've eaten, I'm like, can we get the bill? Go. Yeah,
but I think it's all right. I feel better when I've told people that I've got it.
Yeah.
And I say, I'm going to have to stand up. And they go, okay, all right. Why are you going to do that? Because if I don't stand up, I'm going to have to kick my legs and I'm just going to stand up. Anyway, and then I went and had my heart tested recently and the doctor said, yes, you have a heart that doesn't relax. I thought, it must be like my legs. They must be talking to one another, my legs and my heart.
Yeah, so what's the future for any of your stories then? What's the next steps for you?
Well, I'm just going to keep writing, I hope. That's what I want to do. Somebody asked me, what would you do if you weren't a writer?
Mm.
And I thought about that for a while and I said, all I've ever wanted to do is what I'm doing. Why be greedy?
Mm.
I'm really lucky. I write books. I love them. I love what I do. And I finally saw some reason and purpose to dyslexia through what I'm able to do today.
So if you could give advice, this is what I ask all my guests. If you had some advice for a young person, you can visualize that person how you want. coming into the world, or even an adult, what, and they've got dyslexia and they're not sure about the future because they've got the normal kind of things they feel like it's holding them back, what advice would you give them?
Don't listen to anyone who tells you anything negative about it. Just, I have to admit, it's a tricky one. I can't say this has been an easy game. So I see it like you have a present given to you by a mad aunt who has decided to wrap it in masses of layers of paper. And then she thought, oh, but you might peek at it before you should. So I'll dip it in cement and then I'll rewrap it again. And then I'll give it to you. And you think, oh, I've got a really heavy present here. It must be good. It must be good. And everyone, other children have just opened theirs and go, look, I'm a sportsman. Oh, look, I'm really good at this. Or, oh, look, I'm good at that. And you've just got down to the cement and you're 16 and you still haven't opened the thing. And you're thinking, what do I do? I'm no good at anything. Well, my advice is hold on, get a hammer, bang it and get through that layer, because what you've been given is magic, but you've got to stick with it, not give up, not walk away from it.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
The way she finished that off, James. I mean, seriously.
What you've been given is magic. That's what she said.
But do you know what? She's right. And it is. And if that's not a testament, how that whole chat, if that's not a testament to really what you can do, is, I just don't know what else you can really prove it. We just need to focus on all the good stuff. We are so lucky. We've got to stop thinking we're not lucky. We are lucky to have this. And just listen to that brilliance.
She has such a way of telling stories. Her passion for neurodiversity, for education reform, for the idea that you can turn that disability into sparkle. What a high to finish the season on.
Yeah, and we were treated as well after the podcast to one of her poems that she wrote.
Oh yeah, we were.
We were, and we were so sad that we couldn't record it, but it was just for us, and we felt very, very privileged to hear that.
She said, oh, I think I might be able to remember it, and then it was about 4 minutes long.
Yeah. And she just,
and it's incredible.
She said it word for word and it was perfect.
I mean, this must be the most annoying thing for the listener.
Yeah.
There's this amazing thing that you can't listen to that we heard that you didn't.
But make sure you listen, make sure you connect to the social channels, because I'm actually going to, I've got her permission to read it out for you guys. So I'm going to give it a go. This is one of the things we're going to be doing. I'm going to actually try and give it a go and put a bit of acting on it like she did, because what we spoke about a lot in that podcast was the beat at which you read things and tell stories, and it's all a rhythm. So she's given me the empowerment to now go away and give it a go myself. And you guys, I tell you what, I hope I do it justice. I probably won't, but yeah.
I can't wait to hear that. The social channels for The Invisible Gift, so you can find that video that Andrew's going to make, are at The Invisible Gift, wherever you want to follow us on social media. Or you can check out the website, www.theinvisiblegift.com. Andrew loves an email, as if you've listened to the rest of the season, you will have heard him tell you time and time again. You can send in your feedback, your thoughts, questions, guests you'd like to hear for season two. If you think you'd be a great guest, we'd love to hear from you. We're thinking about diversifying into other sectors, maybe some younger people, maybe some health ministers. We've got all kinds of ideas for the future of the show. We don't want this to get stale, so we're all ears. We'd love your feedback, positive and negative. Andrew@theinvisiblegift.com is the email address. We will put in the show notes for today's episode links to where you can see more of Sally's work, where you can get her books, that kind of thing.
If you haven't, now we're at the last, sadly at the last one of this season. Make sure you go back and listen to the whole of season two and season one if you haven't heard it. And guys, seriously, your thoughts and feelings, experiences is what's going to make this show what it is. And it's really important for us to hear how you've experienced a life in dyslexia or a family member of yours. So get in touch.
Couple of things before we go. The one thing you can do for us that would absolutely mean the world is to share this podcast with someone that you think might need it. Be that a dyslexic person, someone who has a dyslexic family member, maybe you employ dyslexic people, or you know someone who employs dyslexic people and wants to learn more. Sharing this podcast, helping us with the marketing and its reach, and finding new audiences, that's the thing that we really, really would be most grateful for. So anything you can do to help us on that journey, we would really, really appreciate it. I think another thing to mention, end of the season, no guest coming next week. I will be sad that we don't get these weekly meetups.
Yeah.
Next time we meet, which I hope will be for the beginning of season 3,
yeah,
you will be a dad.
I will be a dad. And so I might sound a bit more tired than I sound at the moment.
So it's an exciting few weeks ahead for you.
Yeah. And I'll let you guys know on season 3 how that's going.
I'm hoping it won't be too long between now and season 3.
Yes.
We're making plans for recording and guests and keeping things fresh and not getting too stale with the content. So we need a bit of creative breathing time, but yeah. Make sure you press that follow button wherever you listen to podcasts so that you get notified when new episodes are released. And I think from me, final words are thank you for having me as your aide, as your, what did you call me in one episode? Your prompter.
Prompter, yeah.
I prefer the word co-host. I'm still trying to
wingle that one.
Wangle that one, yeah. What about you? What are your final thoughts for season 2?
I think it's been an amazing season. In all honesty, James, for you and One Fine Play has been obviously instrumental in that. And I can't thank you guys enough. And you guys listening, you are the reason why I do this. And I can't wait to carry on season 3. Thank you for listening. Just a couple of quick notes before we go. They're important ones. You've been listening to the Invisible Gift podcast presented by me, Andrew Kitley, and produced by One Fine Play. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Special thanks to Christina, Izzy, and the Cube Studios. Thank you for listening to the Invisible Gift podcast.